I told her. Just keep doing it, and it'll have to be enough.
Does it work for you?
I never memorized my address in New York. When I had to put it down on a form, I asked one of the other girls, and they laughed at me every time, but never actually made me learn it. I never changed my license from the fake one because I didn't know how well it would stand up to real scrutiny, or if the DMV would do more than a cursory check of the information. But I remembered Sophia, the faded plumpness she grew into after she kicked the addictions, and Whitney's red-gold hair and Hope's laugh, and Jessica's nervous giggle. I remembered Noemi's gorgeous bone structure, from a Blackfoot father and a Cherokee mother. I remembered the way Catherine's smile could light up a room, on the rare occasion she gave it. I remembered Amber's bright, flashy clothing, the patterns never working together and yet always working, because she loved them so much. I didn't remind myself of them, didn't strain to keep them in my memory, because they were indelibly written there. Just like I could have gladly forgotten my mother's and father's faces, my grand's stretchy unitards, almost all the people from before New York. But I remembered them, too. And in a misty way, I even remembered aunts and uncles and cousins, and running around in convoluted games I never understood and posing for pictures I never saw. I just remembered things. Remembered people. Even when I would rather not. We sat up at the same time, propping ourselves on our elbows, as a door opened and a flashlight beam swept into the far end of the garden.
"The fuck?"
Bliss whispered, and I nodded in silent agreement. The gardener was in Danelle's room, seeking comfort and ostensibly giving her comfort as well, for being the one to count in Evita's final game of hide-and-seek. Even if he was leaving, he never needed a flashlight. Neither did Avery, who was banned from the garden for another 2 weeks for breaking Pia's arm, or Lorraine, who was either asleep or crying herself to sleep at this time of night. There was a button in the infirmary that buzzed in her room and the kitchen if she was needed in her capacity as nurse. The figure was dressed all in black, which might have seemed like a good idea until he stepped onto one of those white sand paths. He moved cautiously, the cone of light sweeping before every step, but we could tell from his posture that he was gawking at everything. I never questioned that I immediately labeled the intruder as male. Something about the way he walked, maybe? Or the idiocy of bringing a flashlight if you're trying to sneak around.
"Which do you think would get us in more trouble?" Bliss breathed against my ear. "Finding out who he is or ignoring him?"
I realized I had a pretty good idea of who the intruder was, but I'd told the gardener I wouldn't tell anyone. Not that a promise to a serial killer holds a great deal of weight, but still. I pretty much never made promises, simply because then I felt bound to keep them.
But what the fuck was the gardener's younger son doing breaking into the inner greenhouse complex?
And what did it, could it, mean for us? The first question answered itself almost as soon as it crossed my mind, because it was the same reason I climbed those trees almost every afternoon, to catch those glimpses of a real world outside the glass. Curiosity, among other things, for me. Probably just curiosity for him. The second question. There were girls who could die if we chose the wrong thing to do. If he was just in the garden itself, that would be fine. It was a private garden space, who cared? But if he explored the hallways at all? Maybe he'd see the dead girls and call the police. But maybe he wouldn't. And then Bliss and I would be left explaining why we saw an intruder and did nothing. Swearing under my breath, I slipped off the rock, crouching low to the ground.
"Stay here, and keep an eye on him. And what if he does something?
Scream?
And you are giving this to the gardener to deal with."
She shook her head, but didn't try to stop me. In her eyes, I could see the same awareness of being stuck. We couldn't risk everyone's lives on hoping this boy would be better than the rest of his family. And it wasn't like seeing the gardener with someone would be a first for me. He usually went for the privacy of a room, but every now and then, well, like I said, he was a remarkably self-contained man until he wasn't. I nearly crawled down the path on the far side of the cliff, where there was actually a slope rather than a mostly sheer face. The sand muffled my steps when I reached the ground, and by moving slowly, I was able to step into the stream without a splash. I ducked behind the waterfall and moved quickly down the back hall to Danelle's room. The gardener had pulled his trousers on, but not his shirt or shoes, and he sat on the edge of the bed working a brush through Danelle's auburn curls until they fluffed into a mane all around her. More than any of the rest of us, Danelle loathed his fascination with our hair because it always made hers unmanageable. They both looked up when I slipped into the room. Danelle's confusion echoed but edged in anger in the gardener's face.
"I'm sorry," I whispered, "but it's important."
Danelle cocked an eyebrow at me. When she'd first come to the garden 4 years ago, she'd thought sucking up to the gardener would get her home, and had the inked wings on her face to show for it, a mask of red and purple. She'd mellowed through the years, though, and graduated to the let-him-do-whatever-just-don't-participate way of thinking. I knew what she was asking, but I only shrugged. Whether or not I told her would largely depend on what actually happened. Stuffing his feet into his shoes and grabbing his shirt, the gardener followed me out into the hall.
"Vab, there's someone in the garden," I interrupted as quietly as I could. "I think it's your younger son."
His eyes widened.
"Where is he?"
"Near the pond when I came to get you."
He shrugged into his shirt and gestured for me to button it, while he ran his hands through his hair to get rid of the dishevelment. He was kind of screwed on the funky smell, though. When he set off down the hallway, I followed. After all, he didn't tell me not to. Well, at least not until we got to one of the doorways, and he could see the boy for himself, still waving around the silly flashlight. The man watched his son for a long time in silence, and I couldn't read the expression on his face. With a hand on my shoulder, he pointed down, which could have meant either sit or stay. I was the wrong kind of bitch for sit, so I chose stay, and he didn't argue with me. From the hallway, I watched him walk out into the garden, openly and without apparent hesitation. His voice broke the near silence like a gunshot.
"Desmond?"
The boy's head whipped around, and he dropped the flashlight. It bounced off a rock with the sound of cracking plastic, and when it fell to the sand, the light flickered and died.
"Father!"
The gardener's hand went into his pocket, and a moment later the walls came down around me, locking the other girls into their rooms and hiding the display cases. And left Bliss and me somewhat stranded, her up on the rock and me in the hall. And I hadn't exactly told the gardener she was up there. Shit. I leaned against the wall and waited.
"What the hell are you doing here? I told you the inner greenhouse was off limits."
I heard Avery talking about it, and I just wanted to see it. I'm sorry I disobeyed you, Father."
It was hard to put an age to his voice. It was a light tenor, which had the effect of making him sound young. He was uncomfortable and embarrassed, clearly, but he didn't actually seem scared.
"How did you even get in here?
And could a butterfly use it to get out?" The boy, Desmond, I suppose, hesitated.
"A few weeks ago, I saw Avery pull aside a panel by one of the maintenance doors," he said finally. "He closed it again when he saw I was there, but not before I saw a punch pad."
"Which has a security code, so how did you get in?"
"Avery uses the same 3 passwords for everything. I just tried those."
I had the feeling Avery was going to have to create a 4th password pretty soon. We weren't supposed to loiter near the main entrance. That stretch, a little to either side of that locked door, had Lorraine's room, Avery's playroom, before it had been dismantled, the infirmary and kitchen-slash-dining room, the tattoo room that led into the gardener's suite, and a couple of rooms we didn't know the purpose of, but could guess. Whatever he did in those rooms, that was where we died. All things we weren't supposed to pay excessive attention to, minus the kitchen, and neither the gardener nor Avery left while there was a butterfly who could see them do it.
"Just what did you think you were going to find?"
asked Gardner.
Garden?" the boy answered slowly.
"I just wanted to see why it was so special." "Because it was private,"
his father sighed, and I wondered if that was the reason he'd actually removed the camera and mic from the cave behind the waterfall.
because he valued his privacy enough to let us pretend we had ours.
If you truly wish to become a psychologist, Desmond, you will have to respect people's privacy.
Except when that privacy forms a block to their mental well-being, in which case I'd be professionally obligated to urge them to talk through those secrets.
Funny. Whitney had never mentioned that kind of ethical jiggering when she talked about her psych seminars.
You will then be professionally obligated to keep those secrets to yourself,
the gardener reminded him.
Now, let's go.
Do you sleep here?
Occasionally. Let's go, Desmond.
Why?
I bit my lip against a laugh. It was a rare treat to hear the gardener truly flummoxed.
Because I find it peaceful,
he eventually answered.
Pick up your flashlight. I'll walk you back to the house.
But
what?
He snapped.
Why do you keep this place such a secret? It's just a garden.
The gardener didn't answer right away, and I knew he had to be thinking through his options. Tell his son the truth and hope he buys into it, keeps it secret? Lie to him and risk the truth being found out anyway, because a son disobedient once might prove disobedient again? Or was he thinking something worse? That somehow a son could be just as disposable as a butterfly.
If I tell you, you must keep it an absolute secret,
he said finally.
You cannot breathe a word about it outside these walls. Don't even speak about it to your brother. Not a word. Do you understand me?
Yes, sir.
It still wasn't fear, but there was something there. Something a little hard-edged and desperate. He wanted to make his father proud. A year ago, the gardener had told me that his wife was proud of their younger son, not necessarily that he was. He hadn't sounded disappointed, but maybe against his mother's easy-shown pride, his father's was harder to detect. Or perhaps his father simply withheld praise until he felt it had been earned. There were any number of possible explanations, but this boy wanted to make his father proud, wanted to feel a part of something greater. Stupid, stupid boy. There were footsteps then, growing softer, moving away. I stayed where I was, stuck until the walls lifted. A minute or two later, the gardener stepped into the far end of the hall and beckoned to me. I obeyed like I always did, and he absently ran a hand over my hair, now back in a messy knot. He was seeking comfort, I guess.
Come with me, please.
He actually waited for me to nod before putting his hand on my back and giving me a gentle shove down the hall. The tattoo room was open, the machines shrouded in plastic dust covers until there was a new girl again. Once inside, he pulled a small black remote from his pocket, hit a button, and the door came down behind us. Through the room, the door to his private suite was also open. The punch pad beeped when the door closed. His son stood in front of the bookshelves, turning at the sound of the lock engaging. He stared at me in open-mouthed shock. Up close, it was easy to see that he'd inherited his father's eyes, but most of him belonged to his mother. He had a slender build and long, elegant fingers. Musician's hands, I thought, when I recalled what his father had said of him. It was still hard to guess his age. He could have been my age, maybe a little older. I wasn't as good at that game as the gardener. His father pointed to the armchair under the lamp.
Sit down, please.
For himself, he chose a seat on the couch and tugged me down next to him, all while keeping my back from sight. I curled my legs beside me and leaned back against the well-padded cushions, my hands folded in my lap. His son was still on his feet, still staring at me.
Desmond, sit down.
His legs fell out from under him, and he collapsed into the recliner. If I spilled horror stories to this shocked boy, could he get the police here faster than his father could kill me? Or would his father simply kill him to silence him? The trouble with sociopaths, really, is that you never know where they draw their boundaries. I couldn't quite decide if it was worth the risk, and in the end, what stopped me was the thought of all the other girls. All the air for the garden came from a centralized system. All the gardener had to do to take out the entire flock was put a pesticide or something into the air. After all, he had to keep all sorts of chemicals stocked for the care of the greenhouses.
Maya, this is Desmond. He's a junior this year at Washington College.
Which would explain why he only walked with his parents on weekends.
Desmond, this is Maya. She lives here in the inner garden.
Lives. Lives here?
Lives here,
he affirmed.
As do others.
The gardener sat forward on the edge of the couch, his hands clasped loosely between his knees.
Your brother and I rescue them from the streets and bring them back here for a better life. We feed them, clothe them, and take care of them.
Very few of us were from the streets, and in no sense were we rescued from anything, but the rest of it could be true from a certain skewed perspective. The gardener never seemed to think of himself as villainous anyway.
Your mother does not know about this, nor can she. The strain of caring for so many people would put too much work on her heart.
He sounded so earnest, so sincere, and I could actually see his son believing him. Relief worked over his face, chasing away the momentary flash of horror that his father had been keeping a harem for his own pleasure. Stupid, stupid boy. He'd learned better. The first time he heard a girl crying, the first time he saw someone's wings, the first time the walls came up and showed all those girls in resin and glass, he'd know better. For now, he swallowed it all. By the time he learned better, would he be in too deep to do the right thing? We sat together in that room for almost an hour as the gardener explained his version of things, occasionally looking to me to nod and smile along. I did so, my stomach churning, but much like Bliss, I didn't want to die yet. I didn't quite have the hope that Johanna's mother had espoused, but if I had a few years left, I wanted them, even like this. I'd had too many opportunities to give up, give in, and I kept going. If I hadn't fallen to suicide, I wasn't going to go meekly to my death. Finally, the gardener checked his watch.
It's almost 2 o'clock in the morning.
He sighed.
And you have class at 9. Come, I'll walk you back to the house. And remember, not a word, not even to Avery, unless you're here. We'll put in a code for you when I'm sure you can be trusted with it.
I would have stood as well, but when I swung my feet to the floor, he made a subtle gesture that had me sinking back into the couch. I guess I was the right kind of bitch after all. He called us butterflies, but really we were well-trained dogs. I stayed on the couch, exactly as he left me, not even getting up to wander around the rest of the suite. There wasn't a window or another door, so there wasn't a point. I'd seen it all already, of course, but this time there wasn't the blur of pain and shock. This was something private for him, something even more so than the garden. Even butterflies didn't belong here. So why the fuck was I here? Especially without him being present. He returned maybe half an hour later.
Turn around,
he ordered hoarsely, tugging at his clothing and dropping it into careless piles on the carpet. I obeyed before he could see my face, twisting to sit back on my ankles with open air behind me. He dropped to his knees, tracing every line on my back with trembling fingers and lips, and somehow I knew this was him coming apart from the stress of telling his son. The excitement that perhaps this younger son might share his interests in a gentler way than the elder. He fumbled with the hooks on my dress, and when he couldn't get them on the first or second try, he simply tore the fabric away from the fastenings, leaving me in shreds of black silk. Yet if hope has flown away in a night, or in a day, or in none, is it therefore the less gone? All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. But then, by that point, I'd been in the garden for a year and a half, and even Poe was more a habit than a true distraction. I was more aware than I would have liked of what he was doing, of the sweat that splashed from his chest onto my spine, of his groans every time he pulled me back, even closer against him. Too aware of all the ways he worked to pull responses from me, and all the ways my body betrayed me by obeying. Because there was never enough fear from me or brutality from him to shut things off completely. Even when it seemed like he was finished, he stayed where he was, and he blew little puffs of air against the outlines of the wings. And after a full circuit, he did it again, with kisses, soft as prayers. And then he did the whole thing over again, and I thought how fucking unfair it was that he made us butterflies, of all things. Real butterflies could fly away, out of reach. The gardener's butterflies could only ever fall, and that, but rarely.
She pulls the lip gloss from her pocket and reapplies it with shaking hands. Watching her, seeing the tattered shreds of dignity the gesture helps her wrap around herself, Victor makes a note to thank his daughter for her thoughtfulness. Such a simple thing, but more than he could have guessed. And that was meeting Desmond, she says after a minute. Edison scowls at the stacks of photos and other papers. How could he? Those who want to believe something badly enough generally do, she says simply. He wanted his father to have a good, reasonable explanation. And when he was provided with one, he wanted to believe, so he did. For a while, he did. You said you'd been there a year and a half at that point, murmurs Victor. You kept track? Not at first. Then I got an unexpected present on my anniversary. From Bliss? From Avery.
After that first time, when his father raked him over the coals for what he'd done to me and Giselle, Avery had only touched me twice, and only with his father's specific consent and the threat that anything untoward that happened to me would also be happening to Avery. He didn't slap me or choke me, didn't bind me past tying my wrists together at the small of my back, but Avery knew other ways to make things painful. After each of those two times with Avery, I spent most of the following week dehydrated. Because if it was going to hurt to piss anyway, at least I was going to make sure it didn't happen more often. He still watched me all the time, though, much as Desmond probably looked at those hints of the inner garden until he found a way in. I was something that wasn't supposed to be touched. Therefore, I was fascinating and desirable. The fourth time I had to put up with him started out like the recent ones, with the gardener coming to me and explaining that Avery had asked permission for some time with me, but that he had his limits, just like the last two times. It was the gardener's way of being comforting. We still couldn't say no, because that displeased him, but he thought it was reassuring to know that Avery couldn't hurt us without repercussion. The fact that the repercussions could only happen after we'd been maimed or killed was less than reassuring, but he never seemed to connect those dots. Or maybe he did and just dismissed the concern out of hand. After all, this was the man who genuinely seemed to believe that he was giving us a better life than what we'd had outside, that he was taking care of us. So, not particularly comforted, I obediently followed Avery to his playroom and watched him close the door, took off my clothes when he ordered me to, and let him lock me into the restraints on the wall, let him tie a blindfold too tightly around my head. I'd moved on to pose prose by that point, because it was more challenging to memorize when it didn't rhyme. And I dusted off as much as I could recall of the telltale heart and prepared to silently recite it. Unlike the gardener, Avery didn't believe in preparation or foreplay. Didn't care about making us ready, or at the very least lubing us up, because he enjoyed causing us pain. It didn't surprise me that he went right to it. A quarter of the way through the story, it did surprise me when he pulled out without finishing. I could hear him at the far end of the room, where he stored most of his toys, but even as time passed, he didn't come back to me. Gradually, though, I became aware of a light smell. I couldn't identify it, something like stale coffee or a pot on the burner after all the water's boiled away. Finally, I could hear his heavy footsteps against the cold metal floor as he came back. Then, oh, fucking God, the pain, as he pressed something into my hip that burned and tore. It was unlike anything I'd ever felt before, the agony so tight it pulled everything in me to a single point and tried to shatter it. I screamed, my throat clenching around the sound that tore through it.
Avery laughed.
Happy anniversary, you arrogant bitch.
The door slammed open and he spun away, but even after the tool was drawn away, the agony remained, stealing all the breath from me as my scream finally choked and died. There were sounds in the room, but I couldn't make sense of them. I gasped and tried to suck in air, but it felt like my lungs had forgotten how to work. Then hands fumbled at the cuffs at my wrists and ankles, and I flinched.
It's me, Maya, just me.
I recognized the gardener's voice, felt familiar hands tearing away my blindfold so I could see him. On the floor behind him, Avery sprawled inelegantly, a hypodermic quivering in his neck.
I'm so very sorry. I never thought he'd been so... I'm sorry. He will never, ever touch you again.
The tool was on the floor next to Avery. When I saw it, I bit my tongue to keep the nausea from overwhelming me. The gardener got the last of the bonds unfastened, and I nearly screamed again when I tried to take a step. He swept my feet out from under me and hefted me into a cradle carry, staggering out of Avery's playroom and partway down the hall to the infirmary. He nearly dropped me on the narrow cot so he could punch Lorraine's call button. Then he knelt beside me, clasping my hand in both of his, and telling me over and over again how sorry he was, even after Lorraine came rushing and panting into the room and set to work. On the plus side, I didn't have to deal with Avery for a long time after that, and his playroom was completely dismantled. But his father couldn't deny him completely. The garden was nearly the only leash he had on Avery. So he still had his other ways to hurt the other girls. Silver lining and all that bullshit.
He doesn't want to know. He really, truly doesn't want to know. And he can see that same wish mirrored in Edison. But they have to know. The hospital didn't say anything. You all dragged me here before the hospital could do the rape kit they'd intended. He takes a deep, shaky breath and lets it out on almost a whistle. Inara. Without a word, she stands and folds the sweater and tank tops halfway up her stomach, exposing other burns, cuts, and the bottom edge of a line of stitches on her side. The button on her jeans is already undone, so she tugs down the zipper, then reaches to her left side and hooks a thumb through the denim and her green striped cotton underwear, pulling them down just enough for the agents to see. The scar tissue is bright pink and thickly ridged along her hip bone. Only the edges of the wings are faded to pale pink and white. She gives them a crooked, almost smile. They say everything comes in threes. Three butterflies for a broken girl. One for personality, one for possession, and one for pettiness. She fixes her clothing and sits down, pulling a cheese Danish from the box that got forgotten in favor of the homemade cinnamon rolls. Any chance I could get some water, please? There's a tap from the other side of the glass in answer. Victor thinks it's probably Yvonne because it's easier when you have something to do. The door opens, but it's a male analyst who sticks his head in, tossing three bottles of water to Edison before closing the door again. Edison hands one to Victor, then unscrews the cap on another and puts it in front of Inara. She looks at her damaged hands, at the ridges on the plastic cap, and nods, taking a long drink. Victor reaches for the picture of the boy and lays it prominently on the table. Tell us about Desmond and the garden, Inara. She presses the heels of her hands against her eyes. For a moment, the spread of pinks, reds, and purples across her face looks like a mask, almost like a butterfly. Victor shudders, but he reaches across the table to gently pull her arms down. He keeps his hands over hers, careful not to put too much pressure on the burns, and waits for her to find the words. After several minutes of silence, she turns her hands under his until she can lightly clasp his wrists, and he returns the grip. Desmond didn't know the true nature of the garden for a while, she tells his hands. Maybe a long while, by the way of things. His father made sure of that.
The gardener didn't give an access code to his younger son right away. For the first couple of weeks, he escorted Desmond through the garden, controlling what he saw and who he spoke to. Bliss, for example, was one of the later introductions, after the gardener had a chance for several long conversations with her about what was and was not appropriate to show or tell his son. Desmond wasn't shown the criers or the suck-ups, and those of us he was allowed to interact with received a dress with a back. Bliss hurt herself laughing when she found hers, neatly folded outside her room. Lorraine was the one to deliver them, and for a moment she seemed so satisfied. She didn't know that Desmond had discovered the garden, didn't know that this was temporary. She thought we were sharing her punishment, her exile. The dresses were simple but elegant, like everything else in our wardrobes. He knew all our sizes and had probably sent Lorraine out to get them, regardless of her panic attacks at the thought of leaving the safety of the garden. But we had them so fast, there couldn't have been another way. Still black, of course. Mine was almost a shirt, sleeveless and collared with buttons to the waist, where it disappeared under a wide black stretch belt and became a swishy skirt to my knees. I secretly loved it. Our wings were hidden, but much to the gardener's delight, I still had some wings showing. The black tribal butterfly I'd gotten with the girls in the apartment was still stark and fresh on my right ankle. As long as our wings were hidden away, we were even allowed to wear our hair however we liked. Bliss left hers down in a riot of curls that got tangled in everything, while I wore mine back in a simple braid. It felt remarkably self-indulgent. The Desmond of the first 2 weeks was his father's shadow, polite and respectful, mindful of his questions so as not to strain his father's patience. We were all carefully coached in our responses. If he asked anything about our lives before, we were to cast our eyes down and murmur something about painful things being best forgotten. It wasn't until the fifth or sixth time he heard this that something struck him as odd. That it struck him at all made me revise my initial estimation of his intelligence. Only a little, though. After all, he was still buying into his father's story. He came in the evenings for a few hours. Not every evening, but most of them. After classes were done, and if he didn't have too much homework. During that introduction, Avery was banned from the garden completely, and the gardener didn't touch any of us while Desmond was there. He touched us later, of course, or before, but not where his son could see. The walls stayed down over the girls in glass, not just from the outside, but the side walls in the rooms as well. We went weeks without seeing any dead girls, and though there was guilt at wanting to forget or ignore them, it was glorious to not have that constant reminder of our impending mortality and immortality. Desmond's introduction was like the way Lionette brought girls into the garden. First, you make them feel better. Then you show them, tell them a piece at a time. You don't bring the markings up right away. You don't bring up the sex right away. You acclimate them to one aspect, and then, when they didn't balk at that anymore, you introduced another. One of the many reasons my introductions weren't nearly as graceful as Lionette's. I mostly kept to my routine whether Desmond was in the garden or not. I spent the mornings talking to girls in the cave, ran my laps before lunch, and spent my afternoons either reading up on the cliff or playing games down on the ground. Wherever he and his father started in the afternoon, they usually ended up conversing with me up on the cliff. Liz was sometimes there for that. More often, she saw them coming up the path and climbed down the face to avoid them. As much as he liked Bliss's temper and spirit, the gardener was all right with that. It meant less of a risk that his son would discover the truth before his father had adequately prepared him. That last evening of direct supervision, the gardener started the conversation with me and Desmond, then left it in our hands as he made his way down the path and into the hallways. The display cases had been covered, after all, and I think he missed them. But the conversation petered out not long after he left, and when Desmond couldn't find a way to continue it, because it was certainly not my responsibility to do so, I turned back to my book.
"Antigone?" Edison asks. "Lysistrata," she corrects with a small smile. "I needed something a little lighter." "Can't say I've read that one. Doesn't surprise me. It's the kind of thing you appreciate more when you've got a steady woman in your life," How? Really? The way you snap and snarl? The graceless way you interact? And you want to try to tell me you have a wife or girlfriend? An ugly flush stains his cheeks. But he's learning. He doesn't rise to the bait. She flashes him a grin. Spoil sport. Some of us have jobs to do, he retorts. You try dating when your job can call you in at any time. Hanoverian is married. He got married in college. Edison was too busy getting arrested in college, Victor remarks. A flush mottles the back of his partner's neck. Inara perks up. Drunk and disorderly? Lewd and lascivious? Assault. Vic. But Victor cuts him off. Campus and local cops bungled the investigation into a series of rapes across campus, possibly on purpose. The suspect was the police chief's son. No charges were filed. The school imposed no discipline. And Edison went after the boy. Both men nod. A vigilante. She settles back in her chair, a thoughtful expression on her face. When you don't receive justice, you make it. That was a long time ago, mutters Edison. Was it? I uphold the law. It isn't perfect, but it's the law, and it's what we have. Without justice, we have no order and no hope. Victor watches the girl absorb that, turn it over. I like your idea of justice, she says finally. I'm just not sure it really exists. This, Edison says and taps the table, this is part of justice too. This is where we start to find truth. She smiles slightly and shrugs.
We sat in silence for long enough that he grew uncomfortable, fidgeting on the rock and tugging off his sweater in the reflected heat from the glass roof. I mostly ignored him until his cleared throat indicated his desire to finally speak. I closed the book on a finger and gave him my attention. He shrank back.
You're a very direct person, aren't you?
Is that a bad thing?
No,
he said slowly, like he wasn't entirely sure. He took a deep breath and closed his eyes.
How much of what my father is telling me is complete shit?
That was worth finding the bookmark. I slid it between the pages and set the book carefully on the rock behind me. What makes you think any of it is?
He's trying too hard. And, well, that whole thing with it being private. When I was little, he took me into his office, showed me around, and explained that he worked very hard there and needed me to never come in there to interrupt him. He showed me. He never did with this place, so I knew it had to be different.
I turned to face him more fully, cross-legged on the sun-warmed rock as I arranged my skirt to cover everything important. Different in what way? He followed my example, so close that our knees touched.
Is he really rescuing you?
Don't you think that's a question you should put to your father?
I'd rather put it to someone who might tell me the truth.
And you think that's me?
Why not? You're a very direct sort of person.
I smiled in spite of myself. Direct doesn't mean honest. It could just mean that I'm very direct and straightforward with my lies.
So you plan to lie to me?
I plan to tell you to ask your father.
Maya, what is my father really doing here?
Desmond, if you thought your father was doing anything inappropriate, what would you do? Did he have any idea how important his answer could be?
I would...
He shakes his head, scratching at his slightly overgrown hair.
I guess it would depend on what that inappropriate thing was.
Then what do you think he's doing?
Besides cheating on my mother?
Point. He takes another deep breath.
I think he comes to you all for sex.
And if he is?
He's cheating on my mother.
Which would be your mother's concern, not yours?
He's my father.
Not your spouse.
Why aren't you giving me a direct answer?
Why are you asking me instead of him?
Because I'm not sure I can trust what he says.
He blushed, like questioning the word of his father was somehow shameful. And you think you can trust me?
All the others do.
His gesture took in the whole of the garden, the handful of girls allowed out of their rooms when Desmond was there. But all the walls were down on the girls who used to suck up in hopes of release, their second sets of wings displayed on their faces. They were down on the weepers and the listless and, except for Bliss, the chronically bitchy. They were down over all those dozens of girls in glass, and the scattering of empty cases that weren't enough to hold the current generations, and no one knew what he was going to do when he ran out. "You're not one of us," I said flatly. "Because of who you are, what you are, you never will be."
"Because I'm privileged?"
"More than you can ever fathom. They trust me because I've proven to them they can. I have no interest in proving that to you."
What do you think his reaction would be if I asked him?
I don't know, but he's coming up the path, and I'll thank you not to ask him in front of me.
It isn't easy to ask him for anything, he murmured.
I knew why that was true for us. I thought it cowardice that it was apparently true for him. His father rejoined us then, standing over us with a smile.
Getting along well enough, Desmond.
Yes, sir. Maya's very pleasant to talk with.
I'm glad to hear it.
His hand twitched, as if to touch my hair, but at the last second he brought it up to rub at his jaw.
It's time for us to join your mother for dinner. I'll check in on you later, Maya.
Of course. Desmond stood and brought my knuckles to his lips. Seriously?
Thank you for your company.
Of course, I repeated. I watched them make their way back through the garden. Soon they'd be sitting down in a dining room with Eleanor and Avery, a perfectly normal family conversing over a meal, never mind the lies that hovered over the table like fog. A few minutes later I heard Bliss come up beside me.
"What a tool," she snorted.
"Maybe." "Will he go to the police?"
"No," I said reluctantly. "I don't think he will."
"Then he's a tool."
Sometimes it was hard to argue with Bliss's logic, such as it was.
But sometimes tools could be used.
"Why didn't you think he'd go to the police?" "For the same reason he wasn't going to ask his father those important questions," she answers with a shrug. "Because he was scared. What if he went to the police and his father's explanation was actually true? Or worse, what if it wasn't? Maybe he wanted to do the right thing, but he was barely 21. How many of us know the right thing at that age?" "You haven't even reached that age yet," Edison points out, and the girl nods. "And I don't claim to know the right thing. He wanted to believe his father. And I've never had anyone I wanted to believe that badly. I never felt that kind of need for someone to be proud of me." She smiles suddenly, soft and sour and slightly sad. "Lottie worried about that, though." "Lottie?" "Sophia's younger girl. I remember one time, after we'd worked till 3 a.m, Sophia was at the girls' school at 8:30 a.m. so she could see their class plays. She told us about it after she'd gotten a nap in." The smile spreads, deepens, and for a moment Victor thinks he sees the real Inara Morrissey, the girl who found a home in that strange apartment. Jilly was fearless, confident, the kind of kid who could throw herself into anything, no hesitation. Lottie was not. Girls with older sisters like Jilly probably never are. Anyway, there we were around the coffee table, sitting on the floor to eat a crazy assortment of food from Takis, and Sophia's too tired to bother getting dressed. She just pads over in her underwear, her hair covering most of her ink and not much of her tits, and plops down to eat. Lottie had been fretting about her line for weeks, practicing it over and over again with each of us when we went with her mother to visit, and we all wanted to know if she had remembered it. Victor's been to those class plays. Did she? Half of it. Jilly shouted the rest of it from the audience. The smile shifts, fades. I've never been an envious person, never really saw a point to it. Those girls, though, what they had with each other and Sophia, they were worth envying. Inara. You could get anything at Taki's, she interrupts briskly, flicking her burned and sliced fingers as if to dismiss the sentimentality. It was between the station and our building, never closed, and he'd make anything, even if you bought the stuff at the bodega next door. Working in the restaurant, none of us ever wanted to cook. The moment he could have pushed is gone as quickly as it came, but he makes a mental note of it. He's not naive enough to think she trusts them. Still, he doesn't think she means to reveal this much emotion. Whatever she's hiding, and he agrees with Edison, she's hiding something important. She's so focused on it that other things are starting to slip. He likes Inara, and he sees his daughters every time he looks at her. But he has a job to do. And the garden? He asks neutrally. I think you mentioned Lorraine had orders to make only healthy food. She makes a face. Cafeteria style. You stood in line, received your meal, and then sat down at these tables complete with benches to make you feel like you were back in grade school. Unless you wanted to take the tray back to your room, which you could pretty much do whenever you felt like it, as long as you brought it back at the next meal. What if you didn't like what was being served? You ate what you could off the plate. If there was an actual allergy involved, there was forgiveness. But if you didn't eat enough, or if you were too picky, things didn't end well for you.
There was a set of twins there when I first arrived. They looked identical, right down to the wings tattooed on their backs, but they were very, very different people. Magdalene and Magdalena. Maggie, the elder by several minutes, was allergic to life. Seriously, she couldn't even go out into the main garden because she couldn't breathe out there. If you ever needed help falling asleep, all you had to do was ask her to list her food allergies. Lena, on the other hand, wasn't allergic to anything. In one of his rare lapses into insensitivity, the gardener kept them in the same room and always visited them at the same time. Lena liked to run around in the garden, and as often as not ended up soaked and muddy and covered in plant bits. This created a rather large problem when she tried to go back to the room to shower. Even if Maggie was in the dining room, she'd come back later, find a shred of grass on the floor, and freak the fuck out. Maggie was allergic to the first 20 or so soaps the gardener provided, and even then she complained about how dry her skin was, how lank her hair was, and always, always how she couldn't breathe and why her eyes were so blurry and none of us had any sympathy for her. Oh, holy fuck! Maggie was used to her parents falling over themselves to make her comfortable at every step. I liked Lena, though. Lena never complained, even when Maggie was at her most annoying, and she explored the garden just as much as I did. Sometimes the gardener even hid little treasures for her to find, simply because he knew she would. She loved to laugh and seized on any excuse to do so, creating one of those relentlessly cheerful outlooks that would be irritating if you didn't know she knew the gravity of the situation. She chose to be happy, because she didn't like being sad or pissed off. She tried to explain it to me, and I sort of got it, but not really, because let's face it, I'm not that person. I don't choose to be sad or pissed off, but I don't exactly choose to be happy, either. Maggie never ate with the rest of us, because she said just being in the same room with things would make her have a severe reaction. Her sister nearly always had to take her a tray of specially prepared food, then swing by to pick it up before the next meal. But then, Lena had the time for that, because you could put any meal before her and she'd suck it down in under 5 minutes. Lena would eat everything without a complaint. And Lena was one of the very few people in the garden I genuinely feared for.
because most of us understood that if the gardener kept the twins as a pair in all other things, he would in death as well. They'd been there for 6 months when I got there, with Lionette running careful interference between Maggie and the rest of our little world. And fortunately, the gardener seemed more amused than anything else with Maggie's need for special attention. At least until he wasn't. I was there when that change began, and there was no more Lionette to run interference. Every so often, the gardener felt the urge to dine with us en masse, like a king with his court. Or, as Bliss put it, the sultan with his harem. He had Lorraine inform all of us during breakfast that he'd be there for dinner that night, I suppose so we could take extra effort with our appearances. That afternoon found me in Danelle's room, with a bowl of water in my lap so I could carefully re-wet her hair each time I needed to run the brush through it. She sat in front of me on the bed, twining ribbons through sections of Evita's hair before she twisted them up into a mass on the back of her blonde head. For Danelle, I braided small sections of hair to drape between two high buns, and others to fall down her back. They were too thin to obscure the wings, but they were her small defiance. Haley sat behind me doing something with a brush and pins, while Simone stood behind her with ribbons and twists and oil. I'd never gone to a school dance, but it might have looked like we were preparing for something like that. Something fun and wonderful, something to look forward to, and at the end of the evening you'd have a whole set of memories to cherish. Not so much here in the garden. With the presence of the water and the chance for spilling, none of us were wearing more than underwear. And no one was giggling or chattering like girls off to a dance probably would be. Lena walked in, still dripping from a shower, or a dip in the pond, knowing her, and dropped onto the floor.
She says she's not going.
She's going, sighed Danelle. I finished the last braid and let it drop against her back.
She says she's not.
We'll take care of it. She patted the back of Evita's head and slid off the bed with the brush. Sit up. She sank to her knees behind Lena, who promptly obeyed. It should have been the end of it, especially once Danelle got to Maggie's room. But as the rest of us dressed and gathered in the hallway, we could hear them arguing. Something shattered against a wall, and a minute later a pink-cheeked Danelle stalked out. Only parts of the handprint showed through the red and purple wings.
She's getting dressed. Let's go.
The gardener wasn't yet in the dining room when we arrived, two by two like Madeline and her classmates. Danelle and I hung back to let the others enter, twitching dresses to hang correctly, fixing a pin here or there. When they were all in and seated, I leaned against the wall.
Is she actually getting dressed?
She rolled her eyes.
God, I hope so.
I think I'll go make sure of that.
Maya...
She stopped, then shook her head.
Never mind. Go ahead. You do you.
Danelle had shaken off her post-suck-up apathy in order to help me after Lionette went into glass. I hadn't figured out how to tell her how grateful I was. Maggie wasn't getting dressed. As a matter of fact, she was quite busy trying to stuff all of her clothing, which she shared with her twin, down the toilet. She flinched when I cleared my throat from the doorway, then panted with exertion as she defiantly met my eye. She had the same dark blonde hair as the gardener and Avery, currently in a mess about her face. With her hazel eyes and strong nose, she could easily have passed for his daughter. Which, you know, ew.
I'm not going.
Yes, you are, because you are endangering your sister.
And she doesn't endanger me every time she waltzes in with things that could kill me clinging all over her?
She demanded. Allergies are not the same as pissing off the gardener, and you know it.
I'm not going! I'm not!
I slapped her. It made a ringing sound in the small room, the skin immediately pinking up around the impact. She stared at me, tears filling her eyes as she clutched her cheek with one hand. Avery wasn't allowed to touch her because of the allergies, so I doubt she'd ever been slapped before, however quick she was to do it to others. As long as she was shocked into stillness anyway, I grabbed her hair and pulled it into a knot high on her head, securing it with a few spiral pins. I got a good grip on her upper arm and hauled her into the hallway. Come on.
I'm not going!
She sobbed and scratched at my hand and arm.
I'm not!
If you could have been the least bit mature, you could have been dressed and calm, and this would have all been over in an hour or so. But no, you had to be a spoiled little princess about it, so now you get to be naked and worked up, and you get to explain to the gardener why you would disrespect him in such a way. Just tell him I'm sick! He already knows you aren't, I growled. Lorraine would have told him, or didn't you think it was strange that she checked in on everyone through the afternoon?
That was hours ago!
You got all the allergies and Lena got all the brains, I muttered, and blew a stray hair out of my mouth. Magdalene, please try not to be a complete idiot. It's one meal. Your food will still be prepared separately, and will still sit you down at the far end of the table away from everyone else's plates.
Why don't any of you understand?
She tried to kick at me, and when that didn't work, she tried to drop to the ground. I just kept dragging her after me until the friction on her side made her struggle back to her feet.
I could get really sick. I could die.
That was it. I turned and slammed her against one of the glass display cases, her head between the open wings of ink. The girl had been there before Lionette, before the one who welcomed Lionette, and none of us knew her name, only that she was a Gulf Fritillary, and what a fucked up thing to know. If you don't join us for dinner, you will die, and so will your sister. Get a fucking clue. She started crying harder. Great big heaving sobs and gobs of snot. Disgusted, I renewed my grip on her arm and got around the corner. The gardener stood in the doorway to the dining room, his arms crossed over his chest and a faint frown on his face.
Fuck. Is there a problem, ladies? He asked.
I glanced at the naked, sobbing Maggie and the bright pink handprint on her cheek, as well as the beginnings of what would probably be a charming bruise on her arm where I gripped it.
No.
I see.
Unfortunately, he did. He watched all through dinner, sitting at the end of a table between me and Danelle, as Maggie picked at her specially prepared plate without eating a single bite. He watched as she refused to enter the conversation, or even answer things put directly to her. He watched her roll her glass of ice water across her cheek, while Danelle simply pretended her own swollen cheek didn't bother her, watched how she curled into herself as far as the table would allow to hide her nakedness. As we sat, a little awkwardly, over cheesecake and coffee, he cleared his throat and leaned close to me.
Was the slap really necessary?
Yes, to calm her down.
That was calm.
I considered the best way to answer. I didn't want to screw Maggie. Lena, really. Over. But I didn't want to get screwed myself, either. Calmer. All he did was nod, and when I looked at Danelle and saw the grim resignation in her eyes, my stomach sank.
How long? Edison asks. Another 2 weeks, she murmurs. You know that saying, what is seen cannot be unseen? After that evening, he always had this frown when he looked at either of the twins. And one night, the walls came down. 2 days later, they were placed immediately to the right of the dining room. Victor hands her the stack of hallway photos. A minute or so later, she hands it back with a different picture on top. Together, in death, as in life, she agrees grimly. Side by side, in the same case, the twins are positioned closely together, their inner hands linked between them. Swamp metal marks, the girl adds as he traces a finger over the mottled orange and copper wings. One has her head resting against the other's shoulder. Her sister's head rests against hers. They look. They never got along that well when they were alive. She takes the stack of photos from the hallway, sifting through them with an unreadable expression. After a moment, she starts sorting them into two stacks in front of her. When she's done, the one on the left is far taller. She slides it to the far edge of the table, then lays her hands over the shorter stack, fingers laced together. I know these girls, she said quietly. Her face is still impossible to decipher. Some of them not very well, and some of them were like pieces of my soul. But I knew them. I knew the names he gave them. And after Lionette introduced us to Cassidy Lawrence, introduced us to the part that could live on after Lionette went into the glass, others used the hours before death to introduce us to the names they'd had before. You know.